Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from the wonderful, least corrupt country in the world, allegedly, New Zealand, the shining jewel of the South Pacific, where all race relations are born, and everybody gets along just dandy and swimmingly. My very special guests today are going to be forming a different format to the way the Vinnie Eastwood Show normally runs. It'll be pretty similar, but it'll be a little bit different. Is that we've got two people of opposing viewpoints on together. Normally I just have somebody on, they get to talk about whatever they want, and I act like their best friend. I'll still act like their best friend anyway, except they might not get along. So let's see how it happens. What have we got? Is it the red corner or the blue corner kind of thing? So in the blue corner we have John Ansell wearing the white trunks. And in the red corner for the mana party, we have Joe Trinder in the black undies. Welcome to the show, bro. And boys.
Hey. Hi.
Okay. Kia ora, Vinny.
So, this has come off the back of a recent interview on Māori television that many who have seen it have called shameful from both sides of the debate, more to the point. And I would like to offer this platform as, shall we say, a supplementary, somewhere you can actually have a real debate without being shouted over or shouted down, as I often see happen to people who are trying to explain their ideas, especially if those ideas are somewhat offensive. So, John, can you please explain to us from your experience how that interview on Māori television went, perhaps what went right and what went wrong?
Well, it went the normal way that interviews on Māori television go for me. I'm normally told there'll be one person up against me, and normally there's more on the day, and then the interviewer climbs into me. Well, this time it happened anyway. Last time it didn't. But it's quite good for me. I quite like the ambushes because it serves to show the moderate Māori people how one-eyed their radical cousins are. And in this case, we had a woman, Mihi Nairangi Forbes, who I presented evidence to that Alan Titford did not burn down his house. That's one of the offences that he's serving 24 years in prison for. On receipt of that evidence, her first priority was not to think, hey, a major injustice has been done. It was to demand that I apologise to the tribe, Te Rōroa, who were plausible suspects, but evidently, with this evidence, if you accept this evidence that Titford's wife's father burnt the house down to get her off the farm, where they were being menaced with death threats and stock shootings and all this by the local tribe. If you accept that evidence, that means that Te Roro is off the hook as well. Her main priority was that I apologise to Te Roro, not that, you know, maybe the state might like to apologise to Titford. So it's absolute shameful bias, and there was much yelling and screaming and so on. But basically, I think I put across most of the things I wanted to say. I didn't do it completely because I was being yelled at the whole time. But, it was just another example of bias from a racist station who liked to call me racist for proclaiming racial equality.
What are your thoughts on the interview and how it was conducted, the good and the bad sides of it?
I think Mihin and Angie Forbes could have conducted that interview a bit better. But as with most people that interview John, I think they just get really frustrated by some of the things that he says, that they get a bit, they tend to talk over the top of him and get frustrated, yeah.
Well, in that case, what happens in those kind of conversations, I used to do that to people when I'd shout out. It's either because I know I'm right or because I'm too afraid that they are.
Yeah. Could I come in here? Or
go for your life, son.
I think that the real reason people get frustrated with me is that I'm incredibly blunt in telling the truth. It's not very welcome in this country. I said at one point, when I get really sick of this idea that Maori are not are somehow disadvantaged by colonisation, when all the facts and figures show that they've been massively advantaged over where they were. And for my sins, I just come out with it, and I said, look, because Mihi said, oh, but what about our bad crime stats? And I sort of pointed out, you could barely hear me for all the yelling, but Maori were the most violent race on earth before the British set eyes on them. I mean, that much is absolutely clear. It doesn't give me a great thrill saying it. All of our cultures on earth, including mine, certainly had their moments of barbarity and depravity. But, you know, to say that Maori violence today is caused by the British, when it's only four generations since they were living in cannibalism, you know, the part descendants, that needs to be said. Sooner or later, that needs to be said, and I'm just saying it, and that's the thing that frustrates people, because it's true. A Maori woman, a cousin of Hone, Harawira, has told me that. She said, oh, but I can say that, but you can't. I said, well, I can, because someone has to point out the obvious truth of where this violence comes from. It doesn't come from the British.
Joe, your response?
Well, I do tend to disagree with that. One of the things that John always likes to point out is he goes straight for the throat when he's discriminating against Māoridom, is he goes straight for cannibalism. Well, there's been strong history of cannibalism actually in British history, and examples of that is one of the members of the royal family, King Charles, was actually a cannibal. he used to eat blood, and also during the Crusades, many Europeans resorted to British precisely resorted to cannibalism when they were invading some of the Middle East. And there's also been examples in World War II on the Eastern Front where the only food that was around was human flesh, and people were committing cannibalism in Europe as short as 50 years ago. But one of the things I think is quite funny about the cannibalism is Māori stopped probably cannibalism about 100 years. In Europe, they still do cannibalism in the 21st century. There's still people getting convicted for cannibalism. So we've given up. I mean,
well done.
You know.
But, you know, this is endemic. I mean, all Annex Sykes could say about that was, oh, there were the French cannibals, whoever they were. I mean, I know the French like a good feed, and I know that humans taste good, apparently. But, you know, I'm talking about endemic cannibalism. It's not because – I don't bring this up because it's fun. Paul Moon wrote a huge book about it. It's just the truth. You know, war. There was cannibalism, there was slavery. The British the supposedly evil British put a stop to all of that, I reckon deserve a little bit of gratitude instead of this endless moaning that we get. If the British were cannibals, why aren't we doing it now? You know, why aren't we violent now as Maori are? That's the point I'm making. It's because it's been accused, we've been accused of causing Maori violence somehow because of colonisation. That's the only reason I talk about it. It's just absurd.
So can I see if I've got it right here? Were Maori actually engaging in cannibalism before the British came here? Yes, we know that's a historical fact. Was it widely used, or was it only the top of the class elite Maori chiefs doing it? No, it wasn't. At the time, I think what's happening now is completely different to what happened at the time in terms of cannibalism. After all, there have, in fact, been so-called vampire cults exposed even in Hollywood, where stars and things of that nature will go in and drink human blood. This happens at the highest echelons, so both of you are correct. However, the point of bringing cannibalism into it, although it's true, I'm not 100% sure if it relates specifically to Maori violence rates in the developed world.
It's just part of a culture of violence that we see. And, you know, I'm just saying, wouldn't it be smarter of Maori to go forward rather than look backwards? So much of Maori culture is to do with celebrating violence in some form or other. And I'm just saying that's not hell of a useful these days. Surely, I mean, you've got Maori people who are, you know, heavily not Maori, heavily from, you know, interbred with Europeans, yet persist in, or seem to enjoy this looking back to the sort of cannibal days, the kamate kamates and all that. But it's not that, it doesn't really, I don't care what people do in their own, you know, cultural groups. I just care when they start to blame mine for their own problems, their own poor choices, which manifestly is the case these days with a minority of Maori. My grievance is with the grievers, I suppose. I have good relations with many Maori here in the town where I live, and they support me. So this is not a Maori versus Pākehā debate. This is a Maori separatists and European sympathisers versus 80% of the population, including quite a lot of Maori. That's how I wish to characterise the debate, because that's true. I mean, I get asked how many people I speak for. I mean, I don't speak for anyone but me, but how many people share my views? 9 different polls to do with, you know, whether we want Maori privilege, seats at the council table, whether Maori are special. That was a close-up poll. And the number is always 80%, give or take. The top one is 85%. That was whether they want Maori housing in the Bay of Plenty. But there's a real consistency there. It's 80% more or less of New Zealanders don't want a bar of this stuff. And only a few mugs like me are prepared to get up and say that.
Can I make a point here? How long, you used to be an ad man, right, John? Yeah. When did the PC gone mad saying start to come about? And how long has it been instituted? And now you're trying to talk about something that's certainly not PC. And I think, in theory, the idea behind political correctness is to prevent people saying what they really think.
Well, I'll speak up for political correctness a little bit. I mean, it did start with the German communists. But what people really mean about PC, and my great crime, I guess, is being unkind, being mean. What PC has taken to mean is, you know, be kind, be nice. Nicism, I call it. But, you know, I maintain that we have racism in this country. It's not the kind that Joe thinks we have. I think it's coming from the Maori side. And before we can defeat racism, we have to defeat nicism. The nicism that New Zealanders are nice. We're nice people. I maintain we'd rather sell our country down the river to Maori separatists than be called a nasty name, racist. Now, I don't buy it, and I do stand up and say what I think. I don't enjoy it, but I, from my time in advertising, I know that you have to jolt. To make any kind of change, you have to jolt. The lefties know this. I mean, they go marching down the street and they hijack oil rigs and they do what has to be done to jolt. So I use language to jolt. I will say, Maori have come, you know, from the Stone Age to the Space Age in 150 years and haven't said thanks, you know, because I was particularly upset one day.
I'd like to hear from...
Jolt, but it's not very nice, but
I'd like to hear from Joe in a minute, but what you just said, John, reminded me of a comedy sketch by the Māori comedian Peel, who was driving a taxi along with a Pacific Islander taxi driver, and the Pacific Islander was criticizing him, and he said, "You crazy Māoris, you were sailing across the sea in these leaky waka. We just waited for the Palangi to build the 747s. Joe?
Okay, well... Going into what John's banner, where he's shown that the majority of the people are disagree with some of the aspirations of Māori people, what John's doing is he's pretending that there is a something out there called reverse racism, and actually reverse racism doesn't exist. It's imaginary. What it is, it's when governments go and help minorities who are struggling. Now, this is normal for governments to go out and help people who are impoverished, who aren't doing as well as other members of the mainstream society. And what he's pretending is that anything given to Māori is an attack on mainstream Pākehā, which it is not. It's helping poor, impoverished Māori who are trying to make it in society. And so when John says that that colonization has brought Māori from the Stone Age to the Space Age, well, I like to compare that to the Polynesian race. They managed to colonize an area the size of Russia before anyone had even left the British Isles. They had managed to colonize multiple islands. They had star navigation and celestial navigation down to a T. Sure, they didn't have the wheel, but they probably didn't need it because they had sailing craft that could get around the planet. They've gone from Taiwan down to South America, and they've got chicken bones that they've DNA analyzed to find out that Polynesians had actually been down there, and there's also evidence off the coast of California that in Los Angeles that they've also travelled there as well. And the primary evidence of that here in New Zealand is the kumara, or the sweet potato. And you can find that actually originated from South America. So as far as us coming from the Stone Age, I find that hypocritical. I think it's ridiculous. Māori and Polynesian are some of the most advanced races on Earth. We have contributed to the human race just as much as any other people on this planet. Over to you, John.
Could I actually put something in here? Because sea anchors that are of Chinese origin that are thousands upon thousands of years old have been discovered off the California coastline. A Stone Age monument has been discovered in Vermont in the United States. There are mountains of evidence from all around the globe that there used to be one big global seafaring society with all these different races, and there were established trade routes and things of that nature. So Polynesians are nothing special. In my opinion, there's actually only one race. It's called the human race. And we're all brothers, right?
Oh, I agree.
And every brother has stoushes with his siblings and what have you. But what's lacking here, and I think where the debate needs to be facilitated, is to come to perhaps an understanding of what each other's coming from. Mark Twain's quote was, "It's much easier to convince somebody to believe a lie than it is to convince them that they've been fooled." if you know what I mean. And when we're talking about this kind of thing in New Zealand, I don't think our full history has been completely honest. In fact, I doubt any country anywhere has its full history told to it and is accessible to the general population. So when people have arguments, let's say on a radio show or a television show, about things in a historical context, they're talking to people who have no knowledge of this whatsoever. So because they don't have anything to back up or disprove what's going on, basically they just throw it out the window and say, I just don't know what's the truth. And that's the real difficult thing here, and that's what I seek to facilitate here, finding out exactly what the truth is.
May I comment on what Joe said? Because I know that people will think that I am saying, my race is better than your race. Look at my people, are better than... I don't say, and have never said, that Maori are in any way inferior in genetically or otherwise. Maori were in the Pacific. There was no copper, there was no tin, so you weren't going to have a Bronze Age. The vast majority of humanity was clustered in Eurasia, so naturally, their geniuses were able to compare notes, and naturally, the desperation in which they lived, the climatic desperation, required the Eurasians to, think pretty laterally. In the Pacific, things were better. There was a ready supply of food. So, the Polynesians did what they had to do to do well in their environment. I'm just saying that the fact of the matter is, for all those reasons, the British were a more advanced race when they got here in terms of their technology and so on. It's like if a spaceship landed today, the world would have changed. A spaceship from Venus lands, the world just changed, didn't it? There are various things we can do about it. We can say, let's kill them because they're foreign and they could kill us. Then one of us says, actually, that might not be a good idea because they've got tractor beams. And another one of us says, well, I've actually been to Venus and it's not too bad there. And these guys actually want to do a treaty with us, and they seem to want to treat us reasonably well. They want to run things because that's what they do in the universe. And if you think they're bad, you want to see the Martians. So that was the sort of equivalent when Cook's ship hove to in the bay. The world had changed, and the Maori people, or the Hobson ship, if you like, the Maori people at the time, the leaders, had to make a decision. They decided on balance it was best to deal with these guys. And the legacy of that decision is here today. They're thriving. They're living twice as long. They've got all this new technology. They were smart enough, those chiefs. See, when they went from the Stone Age to the Space Age, I'm saying that was a pretty smart decision. The British offered them a way to leap forward 3,000 years technologically. Now, that was a pretty smart thing to do. They could have had 100, 70-odd thousand of them. They could have killed all the Brits that came in. The Brits would have got uppity and probably brought a gunship in, although they weren't of that mood. The English were wet liberals by that stage. They were going to go away if the Maori didn't want to do the treaty. So I think, it's not about, one group of people is better than the other. I actually have a much more positive view of Maori than many of these Maori leaders, I think. Left to their own devices, in the modern world, they do very well. When they're patronised and made to feel inferior by their own people, not surprisingly, they think, oh, well, we're not thought highly of, so we'll just, we'd better behave like dummies then.
Might I interject?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, you have to come to a break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
And welcome back. I wanted to ask, I think when you were on the panel with Willie and JT, I tried to call in, but the show ended before they could get to my call, unfortunately. The question I wanted to ask was, from treaty settlements and things of this nature, what percentage of it filters down to the poorest Maori who are actually affected the most by poverty? Joe, do you know? Because I don't know.
No, I don't have any statistics on the internal goings on and iwi trusts. But I'd also like to address the analogy of what John mentioned with a spaceship turning up. There's more to the spaceship turning up than it just being better technology. What you're looking at is a spaceship turning up to this planet of superior technology. And what they do is they're going to ban your religion. They'll set up their own religion, like the Tuanga Suppression Act. They will ban your sports. They will ban your language. And then what they'll do is they'll confiscate your land. And then what will happen is 55% of your race will die out in their colonization, as did the Māori race. So at the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, went from 100,000 to 47,000 people. So these alien species turning up in superior vessels, colonization's not this lovely, overwhelmingly positive experience that John portrays. It's actually devastating.
Hmm. Well, yeah, over to you, John. I think I'd better come in because I'll just forget all of the things that you've said. Ban the religion. Well, they overwhelmingly endorsed the Martians' religion, or the Venusians' religion, if you like, the British religion. Said thanks, had the good grace in the Kohimarama Conference of 1860. Some of the chiefs that had signed the treaty, like Tamati Wakanani, were there, and others, had the good grace to thank the governor. 200 chiefs, the biggest gathering ever, I think, at that point, to thank the British for the glories of Christianity. I'm not a Christian. I don't like religions. But you have to acknowledge that Christianity was what saved Māori from cannibalism. They talked them out of it, the missionaries. Banning the sports, well, I don't know. Māori seemed pretty good at sport to me. The deaths. Now, yes, there were deaths because there were diseases to which Māori were not immune. And I think everybody regrets that. And that would happen in an intergalactic colonization too, I suppose. By far the greatest cause of Māori depopulation in the 19th century, however, as proved by John Robinson, were the wars in the first half of the 19th century. There were no breeding. The numbers went from about 120,000 to 70,000, provably. And there was a serious shortage of male breeding stock. That, coupled with the practice of female infanticide, which was not just a Maori thing, but is true of, desperate peoples all over the world. The girl is somehow not an economic unit, so they were killed at birth. So that was the major cause. There was it comes down to information, though. I mean, Joe wants to believe that there was a major cause. The major cause was the diseases. I suppose, am happy to believe when I see evidence that it was mainly the wars and the female infanticide. We're both biased, but the numbers built up again in the later part of the 19th century, and they're absolutely booming today. But yes, there was a hiccup. The diseases were definitely a problem. But I don't think the Maori who are there today would say that they would like to go back to the way things were in 1840 before the diseases, but before all of the other things, including medicines, life-preserving medicines, technology, and so forth, and British law, British institutions. Apiranannata put it really well in his book about the Treaty of Waitangi, which is so desperately inconvenient to my opponents, because I agree, he agrees with me, that as you sleep, he told the old lady that he'd written the book for, as we sleep, there are 100 laws keeping us safe. Now, that's mind-blowing when I think about it. It's true. If I want to kill you, Vinny, I have to think twice because there's all these things that would happen to me, which didn't happen before. Māori law was basically might is right. They were basically like sparrows at a birdbath, wondering who was going to come and knock them on the head next or who they were going to knock on the head. British law brought that security, property rights and security. So I don't know if I've covered the list, Joe, but you know, there is another side to that story.
However, John, you've kind of failed to address some of the points that Joe raised. Like, for example, the suppression of the Tauranga Act, and also the banning of Maori language in schools and things of
that. Let me do that. I'm not an expert on the Tauranga Suppression Act. I think it was 1908 I presume they had their reasons. Presumably, people must have been dying from dubious... the equivalent today would be, you know, homeopathy for cancer or something. I don't know. I won't pretend to understand that. I do have some enlightenment about the teachers in schools, the language. The Maori chiefs themselves insisted to the Ministry of Education that their children should not be taught in Maori-only schools. They should be taught English. Now, this is what is conveniently left out when Maori people say that, oh, my grandmother was beaten. Well, I'll tell you what, at a boarding school in 1970, we were beaten as well. physical punishment was right through the system in those days and ended relatively recently. But if they weren't allowed to speak Maori, that was at least in part because the chiefs saw that English was the way of the future, a bit like Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore deciding that English would be the language of Singapore. Wouldn't have gone down that well, but by God, it's improved Singapore's prospects.
Mm. Joe, your response?
Well, I'd like to address some of those points that John detailed out. And the New Zealand Musket Wars, as John mentioned, which is prior to the New Zealand Wars, he said that many Māori died probably in the range of 100,000. Well, one thing, and also his buddy Don Brash mentioned this in the Oriwa hate speech. One of the things that really astounds me with this, with these numbers that they've managed to pull out of thin air, is how do they know this? Because there were no births, deaths, and records. No one was calculating how many people were in each iwi in New Zealand. There was no records of birth, deaths, or records of Māori. So you couldn't calculate how many people were dying in these. And I think what they've managed to miss is that when Māori went to war, it wasn't to go and exterminate each other. They did it for this thing called mana. And what they were trying to do was achieve mana. It wasn't to go out and exterminate one another as the history that John's portraying. But also another topic that John brought up was diseases with when British colonists came over with diseases. Well, actually, a lot of the British colonists were really badly disease-ridden, and what had happened is they'd spent a year on these sailing vessels coming out to New Zealand to colonise it, and the diseases had spread through the ship. So, for example, in Otago Harbour, there's Quarantine Island where they used to keep all of the new colonists until some of them culled off with disease. So what Māori were excluded from was public health to the 1930s. So it's acceptable that colonists turn up here with diseases, but you do not exclude the Indigenous people from public health when they are also suffering from diseases you've introduced. It's absolutely unfair.
Mm. Now, at the same time, Joe, as you're saying, there's no birth and death records and whatnot. Are you also saying that there was a huge amount of Māori who got killed at the same time as not having any records yourself? Or is this just the different part of the century we're talking?
Well, they'd done some counting of the Māori race in the 1800s. But prior to the Treaty of Waitangi, there was no... the last count, I believe, was probably Cook. And he maybe put the race at maybe 25,000. But, I mean, that's just...
100,000, I think.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure Māori can count. You know, much is made, especially in the Waitangi Tribunal, of the power of Māori oral history. So if we're now saying that they couldn't count how many they had... I mean, this information was gained from various iwi. John Robinson, when he was a scientist, Harvard, I think he was, or MIT, he was hired by the Waitangi Treaty of Waitangi Research Unit at Victoria University. He subsequently exposed their bias and their requirement that he alter his findings because they weren't to their taste, so he's unpopular. He had put out a book called The Corruption of New Zealand Democracy by pointing that out. But his way of calculating was to take the first known census, the first reliable census, 1858, I think it was, and work back in terms of likely birth rates and death rates. And by that method, he got from the whatever the population figure was in 1858 back to a plausible estimate of what the population was in 1840, which I think he said was 70,000. As to where he got the figures for how many had died, I mean, it doesn't matter anyway now. It doesn't matter, but certainly there were over 1,000 wars, I mean, of one kind or another. They were constantly at war because there was no property rights. There were no there was no security. The British brought that. What I'd like to jump forward and say is that regardless of all this and who was right and who was eating who and so on, what child today who is Maori or part Maori is disadvantaged by, say, the education system? I mean, Charles Bennett had the, was honest enough to say that if there's any bias, it's pro-Maori. That was when he was alive, which was a while ago. You know, Maori get every advantage, scholarships and so on, people bending over backwards to help them in all ways in society. What Maori child, I said this to a guy called Carwin Jones, who I accused. He said, you've called me a sort of pretend Maori. I said, no, I didn't, Carwin. I called you a make-believe Maori. He says, well, yeah, exactly. What do you mean? I said, well, you're Welsh. You've got red hair and white skin and your name's Carwin Jones. And I said, what reason do you have for your children getting money from my children? He said, oh, well, my great-grandmother was prevented from speaking Maori in school. I said, well, there you go. See, my wife comes from Taiwan. She's one of those immigrants that Te Ururoa Flavel thinks shouldn't be helped at the expense of Maori. And, you know, guess what? Her son wasn't allowed to speak Chinese in school. I don't think he tried, but, it wasn't encouraged. She taught it to him at home, and I said, what is stopping your grandmother from, what was stopping her from making sure that her children spoke Maori at home? So he wasn't terribly convincing. He went off in a huff. But I do want to know why my children should be paying money when it comes down to it. It is all about money, not mana. It's about money. There's no mana in taking other people's money.
And considering it was...
I couldn't get an answer.
And considering it was the chiefs themselves who told the ban on speaking Māori in school because they wanted to be taught in English, that kind of makes it not make sense anymore.
Well, those chiefs were very sensible. I think Māori today should give thanks to their people. I don't criticise them. Those same chiefs were into cannibalism and all that stuff, but then so were our lot, if you go back far enough. Those chiefs realised that they had been living a sort of counterproductive lifestyle, and they sought to change. They thought there was a much debate at Waitangi. You'll see the speeches left, right and centre. They were clearly of the understanding they were surrendering sovereignty because some of the chiefs absolutely vociferously said, I don't want to be down, down, down while the governor is up, up, up. Go home, go home. In the end, they signed. And in the end, by majority, those chiefs made a great decision for their people, just as we would if the Venusians came and we decided on balance with all the risks of what these guys might do if they don't turn out to be as friendly as we think. With all that, those risks paid off. We took the decision and the risks paid off, and Maori are doing very well today. Not as well, if you like, because it hasn't been a few generations, not as well as the people who had the advantage of being technologically, more advanced, but very well compared with other, native people and with where they used to be. And we're all doing much better than we used to then. I agree with you, Vinny. It is about, the superior race that I'm in favour of is the human race. We're a wonderful species, how we solve our problems. There's not much between us all, and we'll certainly band together when the Venusians really do come, or the Martians. We'll suddenly realise all these differences that we squabble about are not really at all significant.
Mm.
That's all I want, is racial equality, and for that I'm often called a racist.
Well, can I ask, what's the definition of racism? Is it discriminating against a race, or is it being in favour of a race?
It's both. I deplore apartheid in South Africa. John Minto of the Mana Party was very, very strong, a very strong New Zealander in those days. He has gone quiet when it comes to the black majority rule in Zimbabwe and places like that. I think you've got to be consistent. If you deplore apartheid in South Africa, you've also got to deplore it when it starts showing itself in New Zealand and other places, albeit not as extremely. But when you've got people like Te Ororoa Flavel saying that Maori are superior or should get more, that is the same thing. It's on a different part of the continuum, but it's the same thing. And, you know, it's my mission to show that Joe's side of the argument is actually where the racism is. And I think that's legitimate.
Joe, can I ask you, after British colonization, the treaty and all of this kind of thing, I was thinking about tribes and communities, how they worked and how they maintained their sense of unity together, and whether or not that's eroded over time. And as a result of no longer having community and strong family support networks, and this has happened right across society, there's way more divorce now than ever before, way more delinquent children now than ever before. Are Māori a victim of the same kind of phenomenon as everyone else, with the exception that they get racially targeted by the justice system?
So, are you meaning, like, back historically?
No. You know how, let's say, for example, not even 20, 30 years ago, everybody used to know their neighbours? Nobody knows their neighbours now. And all that whole community, all that extended family living with you and everything like that, doesn't exist now. All of those used to be support networks so that people would keep out of trouble and have some kind of culture for themselves. And now what it is, it's television, drugs, cigarettes, everything coming at you. So you don't stand a chance without a proper support network. Anybody's like that.
Well, historically, how Māori lived is they lived in communal pā sites. And so the pā sites were very communal. They kind of lived in a whānau system. And it was an ideal type of lifestyle. So there was a governor Fox, who became the Premier of New Zealand, the Prime Minister, and he once says, "They are beastly cannibals living in hoary cannibalism." And he despised the fact that Māori were a communal people and they weren't capitalist. So that would probably be why they attacked a lot of the pā sites. And so Māori got forced off their lands with the New Zealand Settlements Act, and they had to live in more swampish areas. And so the prime land where the pā sites were given over to the British colonists when the all this territory was confiscated in the Settlements Act. So Māori kind of have struggled being forced off their lands and having to live in these swamp areas, and then having to, into the 20th century, having to come into the cities and also adjust to urban lifestyle. But I noticed John spoke about racism and the definitions of racism, and I'll actually give you the official definition of racism. It is the attitudinal or ideological phenomenon that accepts racial superiority and, when present in those with power, justifies them using that power to discriminate against and deprive others of what is rightfully theirs on the basis of their race. So what that means is the people in New Zealand that have the power is certainly not Māori.
Hmm. So who's being deprived of their money to pay for Māori scholarships? Is it Māori?
Well, no one's being deprived because they are...
Where does the money come from? Where does it come from?
From treaty settlements.
And who pays those?
The Crown.
And who pays their taxes to the Crown?
Māori.
Everybody, doesn't it?
Got him. Look, it's those 80% once again who, you know, who are being fleeced. Look, you've skipped a whole period of history. Maori always do this, these radical Maori. Always skip to the confiscations. Confiscations had a cause, Joe. Now, here's a guy. His name is Wiramu Tamihana. He was one of the more moderate chiefs. Can you see that?
Give me a second. You've got to put that up a little.
A little higher?
A little bit higher.
I'm reading
and pull it back a little. But
pull it back.
Pull it up, way back. Way back and up. There you go. That's about right. I'll read that for you. I shall spare neither unarmed people nor property. Wiramu Tamihana, July 18, 1863, on the Waikato plan to attack Auckland.
He was going to kill every man, woman, and child in Auckland. That's what he was planning to do. He was one of the more moderate ones. The Maori were trying to drive the Pākehā into the sea. Now, I don't think they were going to have swimming lessons when they got there. They were going to kill everyone. They'd signed a treaty, and they breached it, as Sir Apirananata very unhelpfully pointed out. Our people rose up. They were naughty. They rose up. They were warned. They were... and now here's another one. Now, about here, this is Governor Gray.
Down a little. Those who wage war against Her Majesty or remain in arms must take the consequences of their acts.
And I won't put up the other slides. The other ones go, and must understand they will forfeit the right to possession of their lands guaranteed to them by the Treaty of Waitangi. These lands will be occupied by a population capable of protecting for the future the quiet and unoffending from the violence with which they have been threatened. Now, I argue that Governor Gray is New Zealand's Lincoln. Thank God we had Governor Gray, or we wouldn't be here. He was New Zealand's Lincoln. He kept his country together. That's what a governor did in those days. He was a much stronger leader than anyone I can think of since. And he did what he promised. You know, they rose up and he took their lands off them. Now, one can argue about the quantity, and some of them were given back, some of them weren't. You can certainly argue that had the Maori won, they would have confiscated a hell of a lot more than land. They would have confiscated, by their own track record up to that point, the lives of every man, woman and child, and they were claiming to want to do the same. They didn't attack Auckland because Grey stopped them. So I want to inject that into the discussion when we start moaning about confiscations. It must be put in context that the confiscations were done because they waged war on the Crown and lost.
I'm sorry, guys, for the interruption here. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere.